This is The Guardian.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love the audio long read, the podcast of The Guardian Long Read, with episodes about caffeine addiction, the secret life of saints, and Britain's strangest pub chain. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow the audio long read wherever you get your podcasts.
Right now, you're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III.
We are at a crossroads in history today. This is not a moment for more talk. It's time to act. Time to step up and lead.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian. Europe is at a crossroads in history. Those were the words of Keir Starmer yesterday after he hosted a key defence summit in London where world leaders gathered to discuss how to end the war in Ukraine. And crucially, what would happen if the United States pooled its aid? We'll come on to what the key points from that meeting were in a moment, but it of course followed a jaw-dropping exchange between President Donald Trump and the Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky on Friday. The televised meeting between the pair, which was joined by the US Vice President J.D. Vance, threw any expected diplomatic niceties out of the window and ended in a near shouting match that has stunned and worried international leaders everywhere. Kieran, what was your first reaction to seeing that meeting? Have you ever seen anything like it?
Certainly not in terms of meetings between world leaders. It kind of reminded me more than anything of Trump being on The Apprentice and firing a failed candidate from the boardroom. And obviously that's how Trump himself saw it, because he talked about how it was great television. But no, I mean, like a lot of people, I suspect, first started seeing chatter about it on Twitter and thought, oh, yeah, that sounds bad. And then read the quotes and thought, oh, it doesn't look great. But you really have to watch the footage to understand quite how bad a public fallout it was. And just to watch the body language between these people, and especially the body language between Zelensky and J.D. Vance, which looked like they might actually come to blows live in the White House in front of all those cameras. It really was, you know, quite a moment.
Yeah, I watched the whole press conference. I had just 24 hours previously been in the Oval Office at the White House myself, as we discussed on the podcast at the end of last week, when Keir Starmer was there to see Donald Trump. And what a contrast in terms of the meetings, with Starmer being, you know, the ultimate diplomat and soothing Trump's ego, J.D. Vance not really intervening at all, apart from when he was specifically asked to by Donald Trump. And that was one of the things that stood out to me about that press conference, that spray, as they call it, in the Oval Office. It was 40 minutes long. And for the first half hour, it was kind of like, you know, as you might expect, yes, there were tensions evident between Zelensky and Trump, but in no way was it anything that probably unexpected, knowing the two characters involved. But it was really the last 10 minutes after J.D. Vance intervened, and he really escalated tensions. And I think that that was a pre-planned intervention by him, because there's no way, with the sort of the hierarchy that exists within the Trump administration, that he would intervene without having the overt permission of Donald Trump, unless it was agreed beforehand. But having watched the whole press conference and then see how it descended or collapsed, I think, into this shouting match was really unexpected and frightening, actually, because I think when we left the White House on Thursday night, everybody knew, everyone in Downing Street knew, and the journalists travelling with them, that it had been a good and important meeting with Trump, but that things could quickly derail. And a lot of it was pinned on how that meeting between Zelensky and Trump went. But I don't think anybody really expected it to collapse quite in the way it did. So it wasn't just shocking. It was actually, as I say, quite frightening, because the consequences, which then followed with Trump basically kicking Zelensky out the White House and Zelensky getting on a plane and leaving, threw us into, at that point, real unknown territory.
The question of whether or not it was a setup is one that fascinates me. And maybe it doesn't matter, but I kind of feel like it does. Our colleague in Washington, Hugo Lowell, has a good piece today where he's been talking to White House sources about whether or not this was pre-planned. And I think he comes to the conclusion that it wasn't pre-planned on Trump's part, but it probably was on Vance's part. Mm-hmm. And apparently it is Vance who has been particularly trying to tilt the administration away from Ukraine and towards Russia. And Hugo says that, in fact, two sources have told him that the vice president was personally involved in crafting Trump's description of Zelensky as a dictator on Truth Social. So it did seem that Vance went into that meeting looking to pick a fight. And the thing with Trump is, especially when the cameras are on, he loves this kind of stuff. Whether or not he decided in advance to do it, he's willing to go with it in the moment in a way that most world leaders would obviously not be.
And I suppose it ticked two boxes for them, didn't it? Both a domestic audience, because of course there is a lot of skepticism in the United States about whether the US should be spending money and committing resources to supporting, as they see it, a war which is very far away. And the second aspect of it is that it sent a message to the Russians. And Trump has kind of been treading this line, but as he puts it, between the two countries. He's not taken a side. He's not taken Ukraine's side, as the rest of the Western world has, even though Russia's the aggressor. And, you know, if you're being generous to him, that might be because he wants to keep avenues of communication open with Russia. But we don't yet know what the deal with Russia looks like with the US. I'm not sure, do you think the government necessarily knows the contours of the deal, as they put it, either. So there's a lot of unknowns there. And I think that, unfortunately, even if you're giving that generous interpretation, the impact of it has been that it's inevitably emboldened Moscow.
Yeah, well, I mean, just whether or not he's picked a side, first of all, I mean, I think arguably he has picked a side. I think he's picked Russia. The second point you make about the domestic audience is another fascinating one, because yes, you're right. The American voters are much more skeptical about their money going to Ukraine than European voters tend to be. But if you ask even Republican voters in America, who do you sympathize with in this war? Is it Ukraine or Russia? Most of them will go for Ukraine. So Trump is still out of sync with even his own voters when he says that Russia's not the aggressor. It'd be really interesting to me whether he gets some backlash domestically for this, or whether, as usual with Trump, he can take his own base of support wherever he wants to lead them.
And then obviously there was the UK government reaction. And as I think I counted 19 or 20 European leaders taking to social media to post their support for Zelensky, and in some cases to criticise Donald Trump. The notable absentee was, of course, Keir Starmer. And as Friday night progressed, I was kind of like keeping an eye on social media. I got in touch with number 10. You know, is he going to be in touch? Is he going to say anything? And he wasn't. And initially, it felt like that was a tactical error. But then I was told by Downing Street that, in fact, he was speaking to Zelensky and to Trump directly. And it felt that something else was afoot. And then, of course, we heard that Zelensky had been invited, already obviously due for this defence summit, which happened here in London yesterday. Zelensky had been invited to London 24 hours sooner. And on Saturday, we were all met with those images, very striking images of President Zelensky arriving in Downing Street to, you know, Ukrainian flag-waving crowds cheering him on. And Keir Starmer coming out of Downing Street and greeting him with a bear hug, almost like putting his arms around him and reassuring him that, you know, Britain had their backs, before those talks in Downing Street. And then the point you made in your very good analysis of the weekend, that he accompanied him out of Downing Street as well. And that's not normal for the Prime Minister. He sort of accompanied him out, shook his hand, saw him on his way. And it was very striking visual imagery, which to me explained why Starmer had kind of like held back from tweeting, that Downing Street wants to be seen in response to all of this. And this is something that they and Foreign Office insiders tell me repeatedly, is that they want to try and see the big picture. They say, zone out, step back from, you know, whatever mad remark Trump has made on any given occasion. What matters is what he does, not what he says. Now, I think I probably take some issue with that. I think the president of the United States saying anything does have an impact in the real world. But if ultimately we get to long-lasting peace in Ukraine, then actually the route by which we get there doesn't really matter that much.
Yeah, I think that's possibly right. It's an absolutely fascinating weekend. And as you say, I wrote a piece going into detail about all the calls that Keir Starmer had on the Friday night and the Saturday. He did speak to Trump twice in that period of time, which I think Number 10 were quite pleased that he was able to kind of use his diplomatic leverage. And then on the Sunday, he hosted, I think, officials from 18 different countries. Really interesting set of countries. I mean, mostly European countries. But then you also had Justin Trudeau from Canada. And you had, I think, the foreign minister from Turkey and Mark Rutte representing NATO.
Ursula von der Leyen, European Commission. And of course, you were there, Kieran, at Lancaster House. What was the atmosphere like?
Well, it was, I have to be slightly honest with you here, Pippa. It was difficult to tell what the atmosphere was like because they like to keep us journalists locked away in the basement far away.
You went round the table in the summit room.
We were not in the summit
room. I just thought you were just off camera in those shots you saw them round this U-shaped table.
As much as I would have liked to have snuck out of our basement, there was one of the most highly protected, secure places in London yesterday. What you could see from when you were coming in was just the sheer size of the summit. Usually, Lancaster House events are fairly low key. Lancaster House, very beautiful place, but it's actually slightly tucked out of the way. You know, it's not a grand Department of State on Whitehall, but there were just rows and rows and rows of diplomatic cars. There was so much security. I was talking to one of the police officers. They'd been brought in from all over London and the surrounding regions to come and protect this event.
And the symbolism of it as well, because it was where some of the early talks ahead of the formation of NATO were held in the 1950s as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
But talk us through what was agreed.
What was agreed is kind of difficult to know and actually the subject of some dispute. What we know is that Keir Starmer kind of talked people through this new Franco-British peace initiative, which is essentially going to see him and Macron and Zelensky coming up with their own peace plan, which they will then present to the Americans, presumably as a way to kind of counterbalance those American-Russian talks, which is very, very interesting. What Keir Starmer came out and announced to us after the summit had finished was some new export finance for the Ukrainians to purchase missiles, which would be made in Belfast. But that didn't feel like that was probably the point of the summit. And I think later on Sunday night, we discovered that wasn't the case because Macron then went and gave an interview to the French newspaper Le Figaro, where he said, oh, yeah, what we had discussed was a month's ceasefire where Russia would not attack by air or sea or attack energy infrastructure. Downing Street then had to come out and say, oh, no, I think he's getting a bit ahead of himself. But it was really interesting to me that presumably that did form part of the material basis of the conversation, and the French are much more willing to talk about it than the Brits are.
So there's still a lot of unknowns, but it's probably worth just summarising quickly what Starmer said at that press conference at the end of the summit. Obviously, his plan is to act as a bridge between Ukraine and the US to salvage peace talks. So there's four things. First of all, that the UK was going to work with France, as you say, to drop this plan with Ukraine, which would include boots on the ground and planes in the air, he said, and present it to Donald Trump. And we're assuming that in one of those phone calls that he had with the US president, that if he didn't get permission, if you like, or full-on backing to pursue this parallel peace process, at least he didn't get any opposition. Certainly Downing Street felt confident enough for Keir Starmer to go on the telly on Sunday morning and announce it.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, we all know now, is that the PM and Macron are going to build this coalition of willing of European countries which are ready to step up in the event of a ceasefire with others to follow. But there's a lot of questions there about which countries are able, which countries are willing. Obviously, Britain and France are the biggest defence powers in Europe. Presumably Poland would be involved in that. And the Finnish have a substantial army as well. There's some suggestion that Canada might get involved. Mm. They were, as you say, at the meeting. So we'll have to wait and see. There's a big European Commission summit to discuss just this on Thursday. And it'd be interesting to see. Keir Starmer has been invited. It'd be interesting to see whether he turns up. Thirdly, Starmer said that British officials, since his visit to the White House, are continuing talks with US officials about exactly what security guarantees the US might provide. Now, Trump has suggested, as we discussed on Friday, an economic backstop, basically suggesting that as part of this critical mineral deals, which is still on the table with Ukraine, there'd be so many US nationals in Ukraine, billions and billions of pounds worth of US investment, that they would act as a deterrent from Putin re-invading. Obviously, Ukraine, Britain, the EU want him to go further and want military backup, whether that's fast jets or logistic support. And in his press conference, one line from earlier on in his spray in the Oval Office with Zelensky, Trump sort of started saying, well, we could conceivably do, and then sort of cut himself off, suggesting, of course, that he might be prepared to provide military support, but doesn't want to go there now. And then last of all, Starmer has said repeatedly that he believes the US would have the backs of any NATO troops, British, French or other, on the ground in Ukraine, because Trump has repeatedly recommitted to Article 5 of the NATO Convention, you know, this sort of collective defence aspect during talks. But do we trust Trump to deliver on that? That's the big question.
Well, as you were just talking there, a very stylish figure appeared behind you in the glass booth. And I'm delighted to say he is now here in the studio. We're joined by Dan Sabbat, our defence and security editor. And Dan, while I was heading down to the basement in Lancaster House yesterday, you were motoring up to Stansted Airport to a similarly, from what I could tell, pokey little room, where you got the chance to speak to the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky himself. What was that event like?
I've been to plenty of crowded press conferences in my time, but this was something quite different. It was in one of those sort of VIP terminals at Stansted Airport, which is where, of course, protocol planes, prime ministers and presidents fly in and out of, in a tiny little room there. I think the reason we were there was because, of course, Zelensky had to leave by helicopter from Lancaster House, and then he went to Sandringham to see the king, and then he was coming down to Stansted. He was clearly very tired, and you would imagine that he wouldn't have time for a press conference, but this had all been organised in advance, and there were about a dozen of us and camera crews and the whole media paraphernalia. So the room's absolutely packed. We ended up having over an hour with him, which was really very surprising. And then off he went. But interestingly, two interesting bits of colour, perhaps, to start with. One of them was it was off camera, so it didn't go out live. We had to sort of file immediately afterwards. And he wrapped up about 8:45 or something like that. And secondly, he would only speak in Ukrainian. And even when Laura Koonsberg of the BBC asked him very, very nicely and politely, would he do an answer in English, he refused. Clearly, after what happened in the Oval Office, clearly a deliberate act.
Because I think one of the things that's been underestimated about the whole Oval Office drama was that he was speaking in not just his second language, but his third language, right? And there is a lot that gets lost in translation.
Absolutely. I think he was struggling a bit to understand when President Trump was berating him, you don't have the cards, and he was saying, I don't play cards. It was a sort of, there were any number of moments where it appeared to be at cross purposes. So what was really interesting tonally in what Zelensky was saying was there was no apology. He was quite defiant. America's been calling for an apology. He was clearly very, very irritated. He was clearly riled. He was quite tactful in what he said. And when he was asked, for example, were you ambushed by Trump advance, he wouldn't go there. He wouldn't really want to engage with that. Although he did say having these kind of discussions in the open, it wasn't productive. It wasn't helpful. One thing that was really particularly interesting was when he was asked, would he go back and try again, you know, for the good of Ukraine, if you will, that got really under his skin. And he basically said, I'd travel 12 hours by train and 11 hours by plane. And I'd come to the White House because the President of the United States had asked me. And for me, that was a show of respect. So he was saying, I've gone to a lot of trouble to be here, and I'm happy to be here because it's the job, and I need to talk to you, and you're an important partner of mine. But the effort of all that, he wanted to signal that this is not trivial for him. And he got a long way to be humiliated, in other words.
And he was humiliated. And I think, you know, there's a general consensus that the way he was treated was very poorly. But it is also the case, isn't it, is that Zelensky is not a master diplomat. I mean, he's many things, a great war leader. But he, well, it's actually not just because of speaking in second or third language, but he kind of sometimes lacks a little bit of the nuance. He's known behind scenes in Whitehall for being quite stubborn. He's the opposite extreme from Trump, who you need to deal with so carefully. And, you know, we saw that with Starmer in his press conference with him, laying on, I mean, it actually was a bit sort of sick-inducing, laying on the praise, which in a way that's just not natural to us Brits, who are much more reserved. you know, really sucking up to him. I mean, Zelensky's kind of like about as far as it gets from somebody who's able to do that. So it's a real clash.
Yes, and I think two things that I understood from it, one of which is there's been an awful lot of this going on behind the scenes. And we all know that relations with the Trump administration have been bad on a number of levels. And it was very difficult in Munich, for example, where Zelensky was put under a lot of pressure to reach an early agreement, I think, on the minerals deal in order just to simply see J.D. Vance. So he was sort of indicating that. What was also clear has come out after the Oval Office is, and per your point, perhaps about diplomacy, what is the point of all these leaders' meetings? It's about the chemistry. It's about a rapport at the top, and that rapport at the top is non-existent. And he is clearly, his relationship with Trump has clearly collapsed. In fact, when he was asked, have you had any contact with the White House afterwards? And he said, not at my level. That was the gap in which Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron have had to move into, because Zelensky and Trump cannot talk at the moment. It's that bad.
Number 10's been quite interesting, I think, over the last couple of days, because sources have been telling us that they believe that the mineral deal is still on. And in fact, that's what Starmer tried to speak to both Trump and Zelensky about on Friday, trying to get that back on track. Do you have any sense of whether that is still a possibility from the Ukrainians' point of view?
Absolutely. Zelensky said, yes, the mineral deal is on. It's ready to be signed. He said there were a few points of detail that meant it wasn't quite ready on Friday. I'm not sure whether I quite believe that. He did also say, or rather he refused to say what had gone on after the cameras stopped rolling at the Oval Office. You know, the US has indicated that Zelensky was basically kicked out of the White House, that the planned lunch and press conference didn't happen. We all know that. Zelensky gave the impression that there was perhaps a bit more to it, or there might have been quite a bit more back and forth, but he just said, we'll leave it to history. We'll leave it to history. But despite that, he did say the minerals deal is back on. And it's, again, he said it could be signed at a lower level by ministers. He doesn't want to see Trump, but crucially, he is prepared to do the deal.
Now, Dan, you've spent a lot of time in Ukraine. You speak regularly to people out there, both civilians, but also politicians and military figures as well. How is what we saw over the weekend playing out on the ground amongst Ukrainian people? And probably more importantly, more significantly, what impact has what we saw in the White House on Friday had on Russian operations on the ground? Have they been emboldened?
Big rallying around Zelensky, actually. It's made him more popular. Ukrainians felt their country, not just their president, but their country was being disrespected. A strong rallying around the country. As for Russia, I mean, on a military level, it's a bit too soon. Russia's been pushing like fury, incurring over 1,000 casualties a day for several months now in the hope that Trump would win, and now in the hope of just trying to improve its battlefield situation incrementally. The Russians want to dominate Ukraine. That is still their goal. And these goals go far beyond what Ukraine could even reasonably concede. And I think that makes you think more broadly. Are the two sides close to, you know, war exhaustion, where they're close to agreeing some kind of peace that is a bit grubby for both of them that they would accept? And I don't think we're at that point. So I think that all these discussions about stabilization, reassurance forces to go to Ukraine and what a peace settlement looks like, this is all noble and a worthwhile endeavor, but I still think it's second order, because I think the reality is that Russia and Ukraine are a long way apart. And until something changes, and really until Russian maximalism changes, I don't quite see that. I don't see how we get to that point, a point of peace.
Dan, that's really fascinating. Thank you for joining us and for sharing your insight.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, Kieran, where do we go from here?
Well, it's difficult to know when it's moving so quickly, but there are a few things I think to keep an eye on. Primarily, you mentioned earlier there's a European Council meeting on Thursday where Ursula von der Leyen has promised to present European countries with her plan to rearm Europe. And maybe this is the point at which we start seeing the kind of defence pledges that I think Keir Starmer has been very keen to see from other European countries. And there was a bit of a suggestion around Lancaster House yesterday that actually more had been agreed at that summit than had been said publicly so far, and that maybe we would find out more of the details of that on Thursday when Ursula von der Leyen comes out with her plan, and maybe we'll see a bit more leg from European leaders about how much more they're willing to put into their own defence systems.
And there's also been a bit of speculation about what happens next with the Europe-US relationship. Do we see Keir Starmer going back out to Washington, perhaps with Macron, or do he and Macron facilitate some sort of meeting between Trump and Zelensky elsewhere, maybe in Europe? I mean, none of that's been pinned down. This is Downing Street Street keeps stressing that this is movable. It's a very fluid situation. And what matters is the outcomes we could get for any action. But I think we should keep our eye on whether they end up meeting, because Starmer seems to have lived up to his no drama Starmer mantra by keeping a cool head throughout this, by seeing the bigger picture. But he has got the measure of Trump. He's shown that he knows how to deal with him. We saw at the weekend that he has a strong relationship with Zelensky. I thought the King coming out and inviting Zelensky to Sandringham sent a very powerful message too about how united Britain is behind Ukraine. So maybe actually Starmer will be this bridge with Macron's support between Ukraine on the one hand and the US on the other. So we'll be watching very closely to see how all that plays out.
And one other thing I think that hasn't really been picked up on, but you mentioned this actually to me when you got back from Washington, is that there is going to be a series of meetings now between British and US officials over what the security backstop, if there is to be a security backstop from the US, might look like. And it kind of, as far as I could tell, just got mentioned almost in passing over in Washington. And when I asked Downing Street about this over the weekend, they said, oh, yes, those meetings are going to happen, but we can't tell you who's going to be involved in them. I'd be really fascinated to know what level those talks are going to go on at. And are they a way for, you know, the Americans just to keep the Brits happy, or are they serious about actually getting to a negotiated position on that? One thing I think that's linked to this, which may well happen this week, is there will be some kind of debate about Britain's aid cuts. I know that Sarah Champion, the chair of the International Development Committee, is, I think she says she has secured a debate on Wednesday about it. Now, I'm not sure exactly what form that debate will take, but I know she's trying to get other people to speak up against what Keir Starmer announced last week. That could be a really interesting moment for the government.
And of course, the government is funding its increases to the military budget with cuts to the international development spending, which has really caused huge problems for lots of people inside Labour, not least Annalisa Dodds, who was the development minister, who quit over this last week. So another busy week. I mean, I can't believe it's only Monday, Kieran.
It
feels like it's a continuation of last week, but another busy week ahead. Thank you so much for listening. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. And John Harris is back on Thursday. You can also get in touch with us, sending us your thoughts or your questions by emailing politicsweeklyuk@theguardian.com. We'd love to hear from you.
And just a reminder, it's only a couple of weeks until Pippa will be hosting an In Conversation event with the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting. Anybody who would like to buy tickets to attend in person or to watch the live stream should go to the link theguardian.com/Wes Streeting event. That's theguardian.com/Wes Streeting event. We'll put that in the description for this episode as well. Well, that's all from us today. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cucutier, and the executive producer is Zoe Hitch. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
This is The Guardian.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo.
Und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love the audio long read, the podcast of The Guardian Long Read, with episodes about caffeine addiction, the secret life of saints, and Britain's strangest pub chain. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow the audio long read wherever you get your podcasts.